Welcome to the Great Bays Tennis Podcast, episode 181. I'm Steve Smith, along with Yvonne Oseretz.
Hello, hello.
Yvonne, how do you really say your name?
I say my name, Yvonne Oseretz.
I love that. Say that one more time.
Yvonne Oseretz.
He's been on previous podcasts and saying that Yvonne is an idiot. let's go through a few announcements. One, I say thank you. Thank you for everybody who's listened to our podcast. Any other comments?
Thank you for listening to the podcast. It's growing in the numbers. More support. A lot of comments on YouTube and on Instagram, the post that we post about the podcast, where everyone's appreciative and the information's good. We're going to keep doing them. Hopefully the quality and quantity of the podcast will increase. We also want to thank you all for the fundraising aspect of it. I know we pushed that hard in December last year and we got quite the support. So we want to thank everybody that did end up donating.
How about our Theo Vaughn, he does this. We have a workshop March 9th, University of North Carolina at Charlotte.
Correct. That's correct. Yes. We'll be posting announcements for all of that on our social medias, Facebook, Instagram. We'll send out a mass email. Also, if you would like to be, if you're not on our mass email list and you would like to be, you can send an email to us at info@greatbaystennis.com and we will put you on our mass email list. So with that, we'll send out soon a thing about Charlotte and the clinic, when it's going to happen, the sign-up dates. The dates are 9 and 10th, but the sign-up list.
I think also, too, is anyone interested in having a workshop, just contact us.
Contact us, yes, of course. Like
education workshop, educating the enthusiast, from the enthusiast to the expert. With, I think another comment we make before we get started is, like I say, long time ago, former students, longtime associates, you could go to 2 Minute Tennis, Ryan Reedy, and then Jeff Lewis. I think it's just Jeff Lewis Tennis. Mm-hmm. And I think that you would find their content, their instruction that you can find on the internet to be very valuable. Also, I think just a website in general, why you make a couple of comments on that.
Website's improving. There's a resource tab on the website. Type in www.greatbaystennis.com. There's a resource tab on it. We've been adding recommended reading. We have generously, Paul Wardlaw has given us a copy of his book, Pressure Tennis. So that's on there for anybody that would like to read it. We have a Joel Trucker article on there, collaborated with Vic Braden's, great information about brain typing. So we recommend reading into that. And soon to come is the Welby book, Secrets of a True Tennis Master, by Ed Weiss. So that'll be on very shortly.
Yeah, I know. We're just one step away from having that posted. And then also Facebook, Instagram, maybe a comment on that.
Facebook, still daily Facebook posts. We recommend reading it every day. There's some great, great stuff on there. I mean, I wish I knew about the Facebook way back when. I mean, it's just daily doses of motivation, inspiration. So for anyone connected that would like to be or has been connected, keep going to the Facebook, keep listening, keep reading. The Instagram, we're going to keep improving with the Instagram. More posts on court, off court, related to the podcast and just what we're all about in general.
No, that's great. Let's get started with Californian Dreaming. You're from California. Mm-hmm. I've become a fan. I know that you have firsthand experience observing Alex Mickelson. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Correct. Yeah. Alex Mickelson.
With where to begin, but let's go brain typing. You have him down as an ESTP?
I do. Yeah.
Do you know almost every quarterback in the NFL is an ESTP? I remember Vic Braden saying to me at one time, I was flattered. He said, Steve, we should have been training ISTPs and ESTPs. But when you hear something like that, don't be discouraged. We tell people, once you find out where your personality type, brain type is you want to try to be the opposite. You know, the introvert needs to be try to be extroverted. The extrovert tries to be introverted. But you've been around and you watched them grow up. I mean, we could come back to the ESTP, but it's just skyrocketed. skyrocketed. I've done some homework here. He's to be a student of the game. One thing is, you know, football. I told an English coach, Luis Perez, who was here visiting for a week, and you always have to stop and think, okay, does that make sense? He's a pocket player, like a quarterback in football stays in the pocket, American football. Mm-hmm. They're not scrambling. And many times when I see junior tennis players, they're in the red zone of the baseline and they run around their backhand from the neutral or defensive area. It's A-okay if they do it from the offensive part of the red zone. They're inside the baseline, inside the sideline as well. You know, Jim Courier years ago, and I think he's named his company Inside Out. But he, and again, I just read and done some homework here that Alex Mickelson, he stays in the pocket.
Yep.
But I have down, I'll go through this and circle back on that ESTP. Mother's a teacher. And I think of one clip where his mother basically says he just loved it balls. Southern California, you know, you're from there, that it never rains in Southern California. But he was quite young from the story. His mother said that he wanted to go hit balls and she goes, it's raining outside. And he couldn't hit, so he starts to cry. That's a telltale sign that someone loves to hit balls. But when you think of like Taylor Fritz, Kathy May, his mother was number one in the world, late 70s. You just got to figure that a young Taylor Fritz or a young Alex Mickelson, I have down that the mother played at San Diego State, so she's a tennis player. But yeah, you got to love to rally. I think that's something that's gone away where it used to be when people would take a 1 hour private per week. They didn't go to a program, a daily program. They didn't go to an academy. I say this all the time about Jim Lehrer, is that Jim Lehrer says the number one thing is if someone's going to be great, they just have to have that ball coming off the racket. They just love the feel, love the sound. They just got to hit balls. It's their drug. They got to hit. I have down the father went to Redlands. I wonder if there was any connection. I'm going to guess his father would be too young to have played for Jim Verdick. He's one of our pillars. And if you go back to previous podcasts, for Jim, just so many things, character building, team coaching. And then his son, Doug, is on a podcast. I got down in my notes that the older brother is a swimmer. You know him though. So why don't you just give us some input? How do you know him and such?
Oh, well, we grew up, same area. I grew up in Mission Viejo. He grew up in Aliso Viejo. That's a stone throws away. I graduated as a senior and he came in as a freshman to the same high school, Aliso Niguel High School. I believe he played there high school tennis there 3 years and then I think committed, didn't play high school tennis, maybe even went online for his final year because he wanted to really pursue tennis. And then, as everyone knows, committed to Georgia and then decided to go pro after seeing his results skyrocket. He decided to go pro and that's done him very well. When he was younger, my sister, younger sister, she's 19 now. She plays at Cal Poly SLO. She plays Cal Poly SLO, California Polytechnical Institute of San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly SLO.
They have two campuses?
They have a second campus, another polytechnical institute, but it's more south and it's of Pomona.
I've heard Cal Poly, but I've never heard Cal Poly.
Cal Sol? Poly SLO, S-L-O, yeah, San Luis Obispo. And there's one for Pomona as well.
I'm sure some people take some shots at that.
Oh, yeah. SLO is usually the more desirable one. It's a slightly nicer place. So... played mixed with Alex. My sister did. So my sister Sasha played mixed with Alex in a couple tournaments when we were younger. I mean, we'd see him in the finals of many tournaments when we were growing up because my sister would be there. And you know, local tournaments, we'd go, oh, let's check out the finals, and Alex would be playing in some of them. I remember growing up, I just remember hitting with him in some hitting clinics. I mean, I'd say we were buddies. We weren't close friends. Like, we'd bump into each other every day, but we'd play tennis here and there, some hitting clinics. And I just remember he was so consistent. I mean, he didn't miss a ball.
Let me go back to high school tennis. To me, that strikes a chord because so few kids now play high school tennis. Mm-hmm. When I was in Tyler, Texas, back in the 80s, I helped out a lot of girls, boys as well. But I remember at one time, six girls all went on to play Division I tennis, all on the same team. And I use a line here in the U.S. in tennis, the individual is bigger than the program. It should be the program's bigger than the individual. But I think that's admirable that he played high school. I have down here in my notes, he played 3 years.
Correct. Right? Yeah. Yep. Yep.
And yeah, that's, so I also have down, and this is not my input, that he was not an academy kid. Would you comment on that?
No, not an academy kid. I don't want to say he jumped around, but he just tried to find competition everywhere. It wasn't like he was, okay, I'm gonna stick with this one coach, one set of players. And he was everywhere. He'd play this tournament, that tournament. He'd hit with anybody. I mean, I remember at the time that I was hitting with him, I was older, like 4 or 5 years older than him. And I was much lower level. And he, yeah, let's play. And he just wanted to be out on the court.
And you said his mom hit with you.
His mom did hit with me. And yes, I remember one distinct time. There was a couple other times, but she's just after one of the hitting sessions, Alex had to go. She stayed back with me and we just rallied backhands for like an hour and she barely missed. And she put it like right on the spot. I remember leaving those courts that day. I'm like, oh man, my backhand's solid. And it was all a credit to her. She just put it right where it needed to be. And I mean, that's great from the position of Alex where he just can hit the same ball over and over and over, get the reps. So that's
been telling kids this for some time. We're fortunate to have Harold Solomon visit. His grandson was filmed, and Harold Solomon is smaller than I am, and he was top five. He was five in the world, and 3 times a week he had hit 1,000 balls in a row with his father, who was a club player. And if he missed it, 999, start again at zero. That loving to rally. Like, let's just go rally. And I do think there's a lot of snobbery where, you know, I know earlier in the week had you and a player visiting from Canada rallying with a player of much lower skill level and make it a competition. Mm-hmm. Who can keep the most balls in play with this player? Hit with everybody. With how big a kid is he?
Tall. He's a good height, 6'4", I believe, and I think he's still growing.
19. With, I know you and I were at a challenger in Charlottesville, and he had lost. I saw him hit, but I didn't see him play. He had lost. But just the way he was in the lounge area, my guess would be didn't affect his self-esteem. Not that he was cocky by any means, but he still had a smile on his face, and he's played so much tennis that obviously he knows losing is part of the process.
Yeah. I came up to him. I talked to him. I said, "Hey, Alex, I haven't seen him in like 3 years." He's like, "Oh, what's up?" And, I asked how he did in the tournament. He said, "Oh, I lost first round. I played horrible." And then 2 seconds later, he says, "You want to see," we just caught up real fast. And he said, "I got a dog. You want to see my new dog?" And just started showing pictures on his phone. So he's a very, very chill guy when it comes to winning and losing. I feel like he can let it go quite easily.
California chilled with, I have to be careful when I say laid back. Laid back means almost dead. But actually, I would say for so many reasons, you know, people being obsessed by the UTR is that kids more and more, I think there's so much anxiety. But he's a natural lefty. And in talking to coaches, and then reading, and then watching some clips on YouTube, they believe that's one of the reasons that he just loved to hit his backhand.
Yeah, I feel like with a backhand, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy where I just remember his backhand always being great. His forehand has some has some movements to it, but his backhand was always very solid. Like he can always reliably get to it. Well, and reliably hit it. And so when people tell him that, man, your backhand's so good. How do you hit your backhand that well? I mean, when you're in a rally, I guess you'd want to hit your backhand because you've always heard your backhand's good. And so if it comes to your backhand, you're going to hit a backhand. And I think that's where we're talking about the pocket. He can have a easier time staying in the pocket. He's more comfortable there.
Well, John Isner, again, I would recommend people to go to YouTube and just put in Alex Mickelson, John Isner. Mm-hmm. And there's also a film of him playing Mackenzie McDonald. And then Adrian
Manarino.
How do you say it? Manarino, the French player. But John Isner was on the Tennis Channel and said his backhand is a great word. His backhand is repeatable. And I think juniors hearing these podcasts or parents, repeatable. The formula for success is basics, 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 repeat, repeat, repeat. And that was, and that's where I love to listen to a player, you know, like a John Isner, you know, just the player's perspective. And I know sometimes it may come across that we beat up, not the commentators, but the commentary from podcast or from a television broadcast. And another thing he said, his mind, he's unflappable. What do you comment on that?
That's a great word. I haven't heard that word since elementary school. Unflappable. It's a great word.
No, I mean, I say both those words. I certainly have a limited vocabulary, but I don't use the word repeatable and I don't use the word unflappable.
But it's so true. He's on a court and he can be down, he can be up. He's just chill. Like his heart rate doesn't, I feel like, stays at one beat per minute. With competition, I feel like he almost loved the competition more than the winning part of it. Cause I believe he's won a lot. He's lost a lot. He wasn't at the top of every ranking, I think, throughout the juniors, but I do believe he did obviously improve. So I think he's felt both sides. So when I just remember we're playing mini tennis or we're playing that Djokovic game where you hit it down. We play that all the time, especially after the hitting lessons, and he'd just be in it. And it doesn't, like, he'd go for 20, 40 an hour after just competing, competing, competing. And he's in it. I mean, he'll hit with anybody, but I feel like I remember he'll always almost make it more interesting for himself as the match is getting, let's say he's winning too easily. It's not as competitive. He'll start to throw in a little, okay, maybe I'll bad example. I was going to say underhand serve. I don't believe he does that, but he'll make it more competitive. He'll start going to the net more. He'll try something else. So just make it more competitive. Cause I believe that's where he thrives. From what I remember, he's very...
Yeah, no, it's more notes here. Being competitive, I think of myself being competitive, but I've met many people who reached the top 10 in the world, but I think of Welby Van Horn, Wayne Sabin, and Carlene Bassett. Those are top 10 players. You know, or do you go out to lunch, you know, they might remember what you ordered the last time. Ultra competitive. Robbie Seguso said about his wife, Carlene, yeah, she hits a golf ball and she runs after it. With the first time I ever played Wayne Sabin, I was up at the net, let the ball bounce. I'm in my 20s, he's in his 60s, and he could swear like a sailor. He just gave me the hard time for letting the ball bounce. Welby is so competitive. I could say so many things about Welby. He goes to a new city, he's visiting the late Welby Van Horn, same with Wayne Sabin, that... he's going to go to a putt-putt course and ask what the record is. And he's going to stay there till he beats the record, which generally I think with Welby is not too long. With, I believe, Dave Secker, who an Englishman who lived in Southern Cal for a long time, told me that Mark Walpole, who's been a guest on our podcast, that he worked with, along with his partner, Nash, you know, as Nash's first name, Neon, I think, that tournament. That he goes, well, nobody can pronounce my first name, but they're partners and they coached juniors in Southern Cal. And That he worked with, they, the two of them worked from age of 9 to 12. And I talked to Mark about it, called up, and then I talked to Nash, his partner. Nash, I mean, he was a top NCAA player, played at the University of Tulsa, and I have my notes, NCAA finalist at ATP rankings. And his son, Liam, is a year younger, who plays at Boise State now. And I know that I was privileged to meet Nash and Liam. They came out to work with us. But so the two boys practiced together quite a bit coming up. So I got some things in my notes. But he made major changes in his strokes. You know, they have it on film as well. Mark told me he would send me film. I'm very interested in that. Grips and swings. You know, typically he has Mark says you can still see some signs of the forehand. You know, as far as, you know, someone with Mark's eye, someone who's a technician, you can see traces of the old. Mm-hmm. And there's no perfection. There's no perfection. You know, that's where people need to understand when you teach systematically, the strength of the individual comes out. There's always individuality. You know, no two tennis players end up hitting the ball the same. But with with comments on the competition side, having gone to college in Oklahoma, Nash found himself at a Futures with his son, Liam, and Alex was there. And Alex asked him, he said, the kid's always been likable. He goes, he's a likable kid. Easygoing, but highly, highly competitive is what he said. He said he's always handled himself well. He only remembers one time where, you know, that, you know, he was visibly upset that he lost, but it's like, let's, you know, okay, move on. Who do I play next? I lost that one, but who do I play next? I like the term gamer. Mm-hmm. One thing he did say to, this is kind of interesting, he was at this Futures in Oklahoma, and he asked Nash to look at it, watch him hit balls. He goes, why don't you watch me hit some? And then he said, hey, how does Ben Shelton serve? And I think Alex Mickelson has a big serve, but it's Ben Shelton's serve is wow.
Yeah.
It's huge. And the players know that. They're here at Wintergreen Resort. Ethan Matthews was on a podcast. He's 6'5". And, you know, when someone's 6'5", it's like, okay, that's getting up there. Is that if they serve well? And I think of the late Dave Snyder, who recently passed away, the coach from the University of Texas. Can he just poke a volley? Can he just get a serve in, go up there and just poke one volley? Talking about years ago, people used to always serve and play doubles. It was a player I was fortunate to be around, Scott Stewart. And Scott, you know, he'd love to play one up, one back. He was an athlete, could rip ground strokes. But Dave Snyder goes, yeah, we got to get him to just go up there and poke one volley. And someone who's really big, if you can just make one volley and do the math, you know, it's not that agile, you know, serve up the middle. So the return comes up the middle. This scene, you know, Southern California, Joey Johnson, who was a guest on our podcast, along with his son, Spencer, who's now playing at UCLA. I guess so many reports, I felt like I was almost there during COVID. I guess I should say even having my notes before COVID, when he was younger, you know, he'd be playing anybody and everybody, Alex Mickelson, and then, you know, played club level men and doubles, just play. And I think that's really missing, you know, and that I think it has a lot to do with being programmed out. In other words, if a kid, you know, I've said it over and over again on these podcasts, backboards aren't being built anymore because they don't make money. People aren't running ladders anymore because they don't make money. But, you know, I feel like I have a visual on during COVID, all those UTR events that you just, you know, you just money tournaments and you're or just UTR tournaments, not necessarily money tournaments, in the backyard, with, I think one comment on the money tournaments of the UTR, I think that's something that's going to really help American tennis. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, someone comes out of college and if they don't play pro, I find a lot of the guys, especially, they start just banging golf balls. You know, there's just, it's very difficult for a player who's a really good college player, but who's not going to pursue a pro career. You know, where, you know, what's in it for them? Like in the European club system, you know, there is certainly competitive and social aspects, and even there's money for people to play club tennis. What else you got? I got more notes here.
Yeah. A couple comments off your comments, the UTR pro events, with Alex, there's a club in Newport Beach called Newport Beach Tennis Club. And they host a good service, the UTR Pro events. And they're great, what you just mentioned, they're a great way for up-and-coming tennis players to actually make some sort of a living, any living, to just stay in tennis, stay competitive. And their prize money is substantially better compared to, let's say, an average ITF tournament. Men's tournament where you go there. And I think the prize money for losing first round, UTR Pro events are done in a slightly different format, I believe. And I believe it also varies from club to club, wherever they are. Again, you have to double check on that, but you have a almost like a round robin, then you get seeded into your brackets. And at the bracket where you do get money, you get paid out, again, double check, like $600. Which is more than usually you get for winning some ITF tournaments. And so, of course, there's a UTR, a minimum UTR that you have to be qualified and enter into UTR pro events. So I think it's a great way for tennis to keep on thriving and keep on having the young players that want to make it to, so they don't just stop playing like you just mentioned. Another comment is, I remember just something I remember from when I was younger, where I'd attend early morning clinics on the weekends. Also sometimes middle of the week, where you go like a 7 a.m. And we just do this one specific drill, live ball, if you know it. And Alex and Sandra, his mom, would be there in the morning, early, in Nellagill Ranch Tennis Club. I've been there. Great place. Bunch of horses. Doesn't smell too good though, because of the horses. But the courts are nice. You're there. A lot of courts. It feels like you're in like a forest. Trees everywhere. It's a great place, Mishimejo. And well, that particular club is in Nellagill. So they'd be there. Mom and Sandra and Alex would be there hitting balls. And I remember their practice sessions in the morning, just before school or even before his normal practice, would just be side to side, very basic, especially just in the morning, side to side forehands. He'd warm up side to side forehands, side to side volleys, serves, and then they'd be out of there. But they'd get it in. Oh, like I can't say every day because I wasn't there every day, but I would assume most days. And so they just get there, they just put the work in.
And one thing, just in listening to some interviews, there was a mother who was a teacher, father's a lawyer. So if the mother is a teacher, you know, you're not supposed to assume, make an ass out of you and me, an assumption that they get out when the kids get out, you know, so you have the weekends off and then you have a summer's off. So there's a lot of positives being a school teacher. I'm sure that really helped out to get him from point A to point B and go where he had to go. Older brother, maybe I mentioned this, that he was not a tennis player, but he's a swimmer. But Rob Krychek, who's been a guest on our podcast, son Austin has been on as well. Austin, you know, his bio is pretty impressive. NCAA doubles champion, All-American, top 100 in the world in singles, number one in doubles, Davis Cup. That's going on now. Olympian. It's like, wow, that's a pretty impressive bio. But his mother, Sherry, was a school nurse and told Rob, I said, this is something that you probably maybe never thought of, but I used to just ask Sherry, all right, what was the excuse of the week? This is going off on a tangent, but Austin Krajicek grew up where, you know, it was kind of it's okay, let's laugh, you know, because she's a school nurse. And what was the worst excuse this week? And, you know, kids come in and, you know, I didn't get to pet my dog before I left the house and I don't feel well. And she just smiled and said, why don't you just rest on one of those cots for 15 minutes and go back to school. Steve Roberts, you know, he's been a guest on our podcast. I was asking him, you know, during the Australian Open, and did a little bit of a dive here on Alex Mickelson. He said, yeah, I was at one of the UTRs in Southern Cal and had juniors watching practice. And he said, watch this guy practice. And the juniors, he said, the few juniors that were with him, which is probably was Zach Fuchs, who was playing at BYU, Alex Fuchs, who was a redshirt Ohio State, and a couple others. And he said, he goes, yeah, he doesn't look that good. And Steve Roberts' point was, he goes, I've been watching for 20 minutes. And as you said earlier, he hasn't missed. He goes, just watch the guy keep the ball in play. I mean, there's very little tennis played in tennis. You know, what's the goal in the rally? Wait for the person to miss, hit short, or change the direction of the ball. And, you know, do people rally with rhythm? Tennis teachers, you got to listen to anybody and everybody. Years ago, Ron Holmberg, who was, I believe, 10 times top 10 in the United States, he came and did a workshop at this program I ran where you get a college degree. And I remember him saying that, well, if you're going to hit a passing shot, it's just like being on the highway. You got to go a little faster.
Yeah.
You know, you got to have gears. And I think that most young juniors, boys and girls, just hit Mach 10, you know. I go up to girls and go, are you playing Serena today? Who's on the other side? Just trying to tee off on the ball. There's a famous story with Vic Braden is that Jack Kramer, and at that time at the Jack Kramer Tennis Club, every kid is using a Jack Kramer racket. And Jack Kramer comes to watch him play. He watches about 5 minutes. He calls everybody and he goes, you guys can't even keep the ball in play. You guys and gals, you can't even keep the ball in play. I'll come back in a month. And, you know, Braden used to tell that story because it was so motivating, is that, you know, guys can't even keep the ball in play. Why don't you comment on his inner belief system? We always say that number one for a player is inner belief system. Number two is work ethic. And number three is knowledge.
Yeah. He believes he can hit with anybody. And he said that in many interviews, and I mean, I believe he believes it. He just has that mindset. He's very, there's actually a couple interviews online. You can listen to him where he's asked about his mindset, like how his belief in himself and when he's down, when he's up, how he can compete at the level he does. And he just says, one, he loves to compete. Two, that he believes he can hit with anybody and that he can beat anybody. And three is that he has the ability to lock in, as he says in a specific interview I've watched, where he can just turn it on. And regarding that last thing I said, when he played the Aussie Open just recently and beat Wachetka in the second round to get to the third round, there was a moment, final game of the match. It was Lehechka serving, and Alex, they panned over to Alex, and Alex looked at his box, and he kind of motioned with his finger down like this, like right here. And you can just see, as soon as the game started, he was just locked in. And he just hit his returns. I mean, Lehechka is tall, big serve, and he just, boom, big returns. And that's one facet of his game that someone like John Isner commented on, and that he's really good at, is he has a high-level return. So big serves, and he just gets it back, and deep as well.
one thing, I listened to an interview, and I don't know if he was top, he mentioned top 30 in the nation or top 30 in the state of California. In a lot of ways, if you're top 30 in California, I mean, that's a solid ranking as well. But what he did, he goes, yeah, I was like, you know, 30 or 40. That's pretty good. Where I think a lot of kids, you know, it's, oh, I got to be number one. You know, they're just too into rankings. We say the five S's, there's math for self-management, math for strokes, math for strategy, math for stats, and math for score. And I think people forget 1, 2, 3, 4 and go for five. It's kind of like Vandermeer used to say, you know, okay, first you got to get the ball in, then you got to be able to hit it side to side. You know, then you got to be able to hit it deep, then you got to apply spin, and then you have to side to side, corner to corner, and then finally power. Mm-hmm. And Dennis would say, yeah, they forget 1, 2, 3, 4 and go for five. But here's a thought on Southern California. Vince Van Patten, a child actor from a family of actors with the TV show is called Apple's Way. It was on every Sunday night. It was on for 5 years. And that was before people had cell phones. And it was like, okay, Sunday night, here's a family show, Apple's Way. And it was very popular. That's a pretty good run for a TV show, 5 years. I mean, obviously there's the famous ones, perhaps sitcoms will go a little bit longer than that. But he was top 10 in Southern Cal in the 16s. And he didn't play competitive tennis after that. So the show canceled. So he's 21 years old and he starts to play tennis and he becomes top 50 in the world. He has a win over McEnroe and he beat McEnroe the year, I think it was 84. McEnroe had, I don't know, a crazy record, like 83-4 or whatever. So when we talk about Vince Van Patten, we say, fake it till you make it. Act as if it's a powerful tool. It's like the duck on water. The duck just floats across the pond, but they could inside be underneath. The duck is paddling. And I think that's what's going on with a lot of tennis players. But, you know, you have to fake it. You know, Roger Federer's mother, Lynette, don't show a chink in your armor. But what we would say along those lines, I would guess that Alex Mickelson has the it thing. In other words, you know, how many people have the it thing? I think the 2%, you know, where, in other words, they naturally, and I don't think that's probably, I know Braden didn't like that word. People don't do anything naturally, but it seems that he's more of a natural competitor. It just came to him easy. You know, he was, it wasn't like he, you know, needed psychotherapy, psychoanalysis. He didn't need the couch, but I think also parents, perspective, you know, he said in an interview, the goal was to play college tennis. And as you said, he was on his way to University of Georgia. Georgia lost yesterday, round of 32 to A&M. And, you know, winner moves on to the indoors and 16 teams. You know, our fact checker, maybe they've changed it to where now only 8 go to indoor. I don't know, but I think it's 16. And it was 4-2 A&M. So you got to figure, well, if Alex Mickelson was there, he probably would have won a singles match. Probably is a weak word. But he would have been a big, big influence on winning another match playing doubles. He's not playing doubles now, correct? For the most part, or is he? Do you check? Do you follow his record?
I do follow it from time to time. I check up on him. Of course, I'm interested. Doubles, he's very good at doubles. His hands at the net were amazing from what I remember. I mean, they stood out. I mean, from a generation of players, at least where I grew up, where volleying wasn't taught well, it wasn't practiced enough, doubles wasn't played enough. His volleys stood out. I mean, you could blast a ball at him, boom, and he'd drop it, and he'd just have the hands. And forget about grips and swings, he just could make the ball wherever he wanted. Just come at him, okay, boom, he can put it where he wants to. And I remember seeing him play some tournaments. He played doubles. He'd win them. I don't think I ever saw him lose a doubles match. Great hands. I just remember with his hands and his skills at the net, we'd play this game, live ball again, comes up again. It's very Southern California type of game played often, where the baseliner, you know, it's like a doubles format. The coach feeds the ball in, and you can blast it at the net person if you get an easy ball, and kids that aren't comfortable at the net will miss it, and you just hit it for a winner. Like, it doesn't matter what speed you come at, you just kind of drop it, put it off to the side, open court. And I mean, I remember I was impressed back then with his skills at the net. But your question with does he play doubles? I remember most recently, since that Charlottesville challenger where he didn't play and he didn't play doubles, but he lost in the first round. I think he hasn't played doubles since then. And I don't want to throw anything his way, any negativity, but I did ask him, why don't you play doubles anymore? And he said, well, it's not really worth my time. And the explanation he gave was, I get so caught up in doubles. I try so hard. I'm just tired from my singles. And as we all know, with the singles, you do get more money, you do get more points, and you get a higher status in the game. And it's unfortunate because he's a really good doubles player and he should play more.
Well, comment on doubles, Steve Denton, Rob Krychek. I was sent Craig Tiley, who was with us for a long time, who was the CEO of Tennis Australia. You know, and again, I'm a fan. You're an observer, a former practice partner. There's some things here I want to turn this podcast into a lesson. I mean, right now, again, just being a fan. But the Australian Open, and they've got concerts going on. They got all sorts of entertainment. There's a food court. And there's just no one watching doubles. And then, you know, the mixed is, I think they split $112,000. And, you know, years ago, if I was commissioner for tennis for a day, is that it'd be great to have one ranking, you know, that was doubles and singles all combined. And, you know, I think when Nadal first won, the Australian Open on hard court, he said, I would never say this, but now they've won on a major on a hard court, he goes, they need to have more tennis played on clay. He goes, I'm not saying that because I prefer clay. But he said, when I'm an old man, I want to be able to play football. You know, our version, our word is soccer. But with doubles, it's so good for your game. I mean, at the futures level, though, there's, you know, obviously he's progressed, you know, futures to challenger. Now he's 73 in the world. You know, that ranking would still put him in qualies at some of the ATP indoor events where the draw is only 32. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to play doubles, you know, like Patrick Gibson, in another podcast, we're going to just go through some odds and ends. The next podcast, go through some odds and ends on the Australian Open. It's good for returns. I mean, it's good for your serve. You know, a lot of people say, I'd rather play doubles than practice. Just in my research, in one interview, I heard him say, well, my old coach, Jason, so, you know, one of these things, you never want to leave someone out. But how's it go? It takes a village to raise a child, but no one tells you where the village is or how to get there. I mean, and certainly Southern California tennis is more than a village. With Eric Diaz and his partner, if I'm pronouncing it right, Jay Levitt. I listened to a podcast with Eric Diaz. His current, you know, he was a person in the booth, in the box. He was with Alex Mickelson. His father, you know, Eric was born into tennis. His father was a guest on our podcast. We're trying to carry the torch and, you know, why would we want to interview Manny Diaz? Well, he has years and years of college coaching experience. He's won national championships. He himself was a player, but going way back that, you know, he's from Puerto Rico and he was taught by Welby Van Horn. He was taught to play by Welby. I was taught to coach by Welby. So Eric obviously was born into tennis and, you know, to play, played for his father. I guess I should go back and say, I sent Manny a text. And all the text was, because I, you know, I was watching Mickelson play and I sent Manny a text and said, hey, your kid's way better looking than you. I mean, I think they look just like exactly alike. So with being born into tennis, he was a player too, Eric. I mean, I think I read where he won 95 matches, 95 doubles matches. So to grow up in Athens, Georgia, a small town, obviously there's an influence, you know, being in that culture. I mean, what, like Brian Shelton and his wife, growing up, on a college campus, being around big time sports. Mm-hmm. That's certainly a perk with, it seems like you've had so many connections where Greg Patton, whose sister Colleen works here at Wintergreen, he was here. We had him on as a guest. I would encourage people to go back and listen to Greg Patton's. It's great to listen to Greg Patton. He has just so much enthusiasm for tennis. He's retired now, but he was at Boise State for a long, long time. And Eric worked as his assistant coach. Eric also, with the USTA, another Welby Van Horn prodigy, Andy Brandy, you know, who's done so many different things in tennis, was a national coach when Eric did his internship, and Jose Garris. So he has an amazing background. And he went to Coto de Caz, I believe. And I think if that's right, I mean, I know right where the courts are. It's right behind the old Vic Braden Tennis College. And he said he went down and set up a program with lower fees because he had, you know, you don't roll into Southern California. Mm-hmm. Ed Crass, who's been on our podcast, Mr. Ghost Doubles, one-on-one doubles, he once said about Tampa, and certainly Southern California is just like Florida. Ed said, if you can make it in this town in tennis, you can make it in this town, you make it anywhere. That's an old line from New York City. But so he went in and he started his program. And, you know, initially he had to secure courts. Initially he started with lower fees. Sounds like he hit the gold mine with Alex Mickelson. But you just got to figure that if he grew up under his father's watch and all the different experiences with working under another college coach, what he did with the USTA, playing the game himself, that was, I'm sure, a very good transition from if he was working with Mark and Nash and say this other coach that you mentioned, Jason, I'm just going to guess that the language was that of a college tennis environment. You know, it wasn't, you know, they're not talking to him like club kids. I did read where Alex Mickelson said that it was between Eric and Jay, who were partners, is a good cop, bad cop. And with Eric Diaz being more the intense bad cop and Jay Leavitt being the easygoing cop. So I think that's good to have that transition or that, excuse me, that balance or that difference with, we'll come back to ESTP. We mentioned that in the beginning, but to make this a lesson, people be wise, coaches, parents, players, to just go watch some of the match that he played at Newport, where he got to the finals. And there's a funny line where his father said, where he was saying he wanted to go pro. And he goes, yeah, you're going to go pro in real estate. You know, to make money in tennis is like, you know, my son played tennis. He got to be 200 in the world, but you know, 200 in the world, you know, he didn't make money. He made money, but he didn't make money. I mean, the expenses exceeded revenue generated. But that he did so well that he was like, oh, he didn't end up going to the University of Georgia. But Newport, excuse me, the grass is more like the old grass at Wimbledon. And, you know, that's where Raven Claussen, another person we had on our podcast who, you know, he said if it wasn't for that tournament, he would have become a pro double specialist early. But I think he got to the, our fact checker, he got to the semis. Rajiv Ram, fact checker, he won it twice. And I really wish that Wimbledon still was the old grass, because the contrast to go from the red clay at the French to the fast grass, you know, now people are playing very much the same on every surface. But why juniors and coaches and parents could benefit by watching Alex Mickelson play, and that's where I go, watch this kid. You know, I was watching it in the summer, and this guy stays in the pocket. He's close to the baseline. You know, I don't consider myself a fan of tennis, more of a student of tennis. I think his backhand and forehand return could be a little bit more Jimbo-like, Jimmy Connors, but they're close. You know, we say tabletop, turn like a volley. You know, it's wall to the ball and steal the ace. Bud Collins, steal the ace. That serve's coming in Mach 10, and you line it up and counter speed with speed. But he can do that. I'd say he's just a little more wobbly than Connors, but he has that option. And most kids, they can't do that. They're so far back returning serve, and they don't have the options. And then, you know, he served and volleyed. You know, it wasn't like he was a one-dimensional staying back. But again, he gets the short ball, and he comes in. He you know, I know you've said that because you've helped out with so many different tactical videos, geometry, point A to point B. And I mean, we're talking about UTR tournaments, a chapter of my life. You know, I would say it's the Battle of Boca, which is a nice service, South Florida, similar to Southern Cal, lots of tennis. That I saw some good players, but I didn't see one great player. Better word be, it was there 2 years, I didn't see one solid player. Alex Mickelson's a solid player. And it's because of so many factors. You know, we're talking about his it thing and, you know, his ability to compete, unflappable. And, but he doesn't put himself out of position. You know, I read where, it's online. I mean, you can see Eric Diaz helping him with his one-handed backhand volley, and that he hit two-handed. And, you know, you actually can hit a two-handed backhand volley. Coming back to Connors, I think Fru McMillan hit two hands on both sides, and he was number one doubles player in the world. People say, wow, that was old school. You know, that's where old school, new school, there is no school. I think the way Connors played tennis in the 70s with his T2000, I've been at quite a few NCAA tournaments here in recent years and going way back. I think the way Connors played in the 70s would hold up today. But yeah, to just go and watch, there's clips of him playing where you could watch him play. Just put it, just, you know, it's also playing, he's plays Mackenzie McDonald. And there's a guy who, you know, great base. We need to change the name. Are you a great baser? It has solid fundamentals. And he's so fast. But I would say that Alex Mickelson plays principle-based tennis, where he knows the zones of the court. You know, that doesn't mean he's, you know, in our school thought he's going to call it red zone, yellow zone, green zone. How's it go with Paul Wardlaw? It's working backwards at the green zone. He calls that the point ending situation. We use that all the time. Try it. If you're going to lose a point, lose in a point ending situation. Kill or be killed. You want to force. You're building in the back, you're transitioning the midcourt. Baltieri, his was a control, hurt, finish. You know, so, but, you know, I just see people just, that's kind of going Battle of Boca. There's another one. I mean, it's just amazing. Almost everyone is just looking to hit forehands. And for our listeners, if people, you know, just chart, you know, juniors are rallying balls, hit 10 down the middle, safe bet they hit 7 or 8. Even in the warm-up, they don't hit a backhand. And we're always telling juniors, you know, they go, well, that's a negative. The late Peter Berwash used to say the best place to teach tennis is where people have not seen the pros play. Initially, it's not good, in my opinion, for juniors to see pros play because they can't interpret it. And, you know, they see it and it's like, well, that's what the pros do. And it's like, come on. I know growing up in hockey, I mean, if I were to say, well, I watched so-and-so in the NHL do it, you just would be told, shut up. You know, learn fundamentals, learn basics. And, you know, people can't figure it out. Well, people think we never want anyone to run around the back end. Well, that's not true. We take Burwash's concept in the red zone, go defensive, neutral, offensive. You can run around a back end, but don't do it where you're running the wrong way. You know, the court less than 20 degrees, you move further back. Heard Pam Shriver say this one time. I'm not sure, it probably comes from her first coach a long time ago, Don Candy. I remember being at a workshop listening to him. Is that kid makes a tennis court look like an aircraft carrier because they're just going further back and further back. And he goes, you need to make it look like a postage stamp. Now we take kids up to the net, say, stop. You know, you can reach over the net, 180 degrees. You hit east and west. Rules don't allow that. Go 3 feet back and you go from 180 to 130. You just say, stop and look. This is a beautiful view. I don't think there's hesitation for Alex Mickelson to go forward, but it seems, you know, from what I've read, he's in transition. He's playing pro tennis. He's cracked the top 100 in the world. He's 19 years old, skyrocketed to the top. And it's a work in process and progress where he's still working on a backhand volley, transitioning to a one-handed backhand volley. But I don't think it's stopping him from going in. But no, there's so many lessons. You know, I think Max Cressy, he has a win over Cressy. Cressy spent some time with us and it was, you know, he was at my place for 3 weeks and that was through Matt Clure and Andy Fitzell. And, you know, things go up and down, but I would say with Cressy right now, people have a book on him. They know he's coming first and second. And, but you know, so you know, that's been a win. He beat Nisha Corey, who's faster than fast. Those wins were pretty convincing, you know. But with Eric Diaz, I think he, from what I read and heard, is he kept the guy very grounded. I want to turn pro. I want to turn pro. I want to go pro. I want to go pro. And he goes, you know, and Eric's saying, no, you have a lot more to prove before. I do think that there's a connection between Eric Diaz and certainly Alex he's headed to go to the University of Georgia. But I do think when you have those type of wins, you know, I went to the Davis Cup, in 2007 in Portland when, US beat Russia. I had some good seats cause I'd gone out to the Roddick Tennis Academy a few times and Andy's agent, you know, hooked me up with some really good tickets and with, you know, Andy Roddick turned pro where James Blake and the two Bryan brothers had gone to college. And, you know, the Bryan brothers and James Blake would say, well, Andy Roddick was ready to be a pro at that young age. And James Blake would be the first one to say that he wasn't ready at that time.
Steve, with Eric Diaz, I heard you talking with him over the phone about Alex, something about his forehand volley and how he'd have a grip on three initially.
No, that was not with Eric. I talked to Mark Walpole and Nash who worked with him. So go ahead.
But I was going to say that was that accurate as what I overheard, the grip on three for the forehand volley, and they just said, leave it if it goes in. I mean,
I think coming back to Ryan Reedy, through Jim Klein, and Ryan spent so many years with Jim Klein, 20 some. And he's an outlier. He started teaching tennis as a teenager. And so, I was just asked to critique something that Ryan did by Jim. And I said, Braden would talk about the racket face. You know, he'd say, yeah, this is you can volley with any grip you want, but you got to get the racket face vertical to hit. It's like Johnny Mack, you know, he'd raise that elbow and he'd jump on his forehand volley because he couldn't go that, he couldn't go way out in front because of the grip. And, you know, whether the pro will articulate that point, and I don't think most touring pros do. I have to listen to commentators. Most of them are foreign touring pros. But it's dealing with a racket face. That, no, you don't have to get a strong continental. The racket face doesn't have to be open at a 45-degree angle. I had a coach that I worked closely with tell me the other day that he showed some film. A girl's gone up high enough to be with the Federation girl that we've worked with, and said, well, that's a doubles volley. You know, a volley's a volley. There is some truth. I mean, you could flip it and go, actually, there's times where, well, for sure, juniors, when they play doubles, they're trying to hit the volley so big. You got to make your first serve, make your first volley, form a wall up at the net, and just like singles, do the doubles. You form a wall up at the net, can you win 2 out of 3? 2 out of 3 is phenomenal. But no, you're playing against someone. If you make your first serve and make your first volley, if you can center the volley and hit it 3/4 court, especially with people that have extreme grips, that's a great play. I mean, that's where in our world, if you really know the basics of tennis, you know, tennis tech 101, technology 101, then the information grows. But no, I think the racket face that no, he doesn't. You know, Mark or Nash, I think it was Nash, was telling me the conversation. No, he doesn't need to change that. No, and watching him play, that's another thing too, is that like Pete Sampras, you know, he added a segment to his forehand. You know, Vic, people would ask me, if you disagree with anything that Vic said? I said, no, because he backed it with scientific rationale. But at one point, Vic, I used to do traveling clinics with Vic. And early on, I would do the video inside and he'd be outside. As he got older, it flip-flopped where he'd be inside doing the classroom side of it. And he talked about how, you know, Agassi with his elbow raised and a pre-stretch, an extra segment. And I can remember so many juniors going, I want to hit like Agassi. I want to raise my elbow. And again, coming back to the comment I made earlier, it's very dangerous. I would say it's even counterproductive when kids are copying pros. So I'm certainly repeating myself from these podcasts, but I think for the tennis teachers, especially those that are, you know, working their way into becoming a competent tennis teacher, kid goes to a jazz concert. You know, that's, you're going to be inspired. Say you play the saxophone. You're going to learn to play saxophone. You got to go to an instructor. And, you know, someone, you know, show me how to hang on to the instrument. Show me where I need to put my fingers. And, you know, that's come over and over again. Richard Hernandez, you know, how can you improve tennis in Canada? Grips. Not a sentence, just a word. Grips. But no, I think when you, you know, a Canadian kid who's been visiting here, he watched Spencer Johnson play a match. UCLA was playing A&M, and we're doing some work off of that tape. And so the junior asked me to watch it. I said, yeah, sure, I'll watch it. And he goes, oh, he's definitely a great bass. And Denis Shapovalov spent 10 years at the club he trains at, 10 years. His mother worked there. And, you know, Denis, I think when Jimmy Airy said, I love how he comes to the net, but when he gets there, he doesn't know what to do. I can remember, you know, training sessions with the staff on the phone saying, no, the mother's name is Tessa. And obviously hats off to anybody's kid who's playing tennis at these majors and traveling around the world. And so Shapovalov, you know, it's like with Coco Gauff. Oh yeah, we can talk about her grip just like everybody else on the forehand side, but she's teaching us. You know, fitness, mental toughness. She's teaching us. You know, we're all students of Coco. We should all be students of Coco Gauff. And you can hit the ball with any grip you want. But that's where with Shapovalov, it shouldn't have been about the grips. It should have been about the racket face. And that's where it comes back to Vic Braden, the man, and Vic Braden, the resource. Now, Craig Tiley went to the University of Illinois. You know, that's kind of ancient history now. I think it was 2003, and he's known as the best tournament director. People love Tiley, and it's amazing what he's done with the entertainment side of the Australian Open. But when Tiley went to Illinois, if he walked in a room, Braden wouldn't have known who he was. But he knew Vic Braden backwards and forwards. You know, Ryan Reedy, I would say backwards and forwards. Now, Jeff Lewis, he worked with Braden. But Braden, the man, you know, on TV, you'd say grip on 1, grip on 2, grip on 3. And I think it's great that people are going back and looking at old clips, but there's a lot to be said about reading a book versus living the book. So yeah, that was part of the conversation, definitely with grips and swings, Mark Walpole and Nash Norman, for mispronouncing it, I'm sure. But again, I think going to those clips, the grass court tournament, grass is a teacher, and it's old grass. You know, it's not new grass. Like, you know, Wimbledon in 2002, I think it was, the fact checker. 2002, they changed the grass, and now Bandian played Hewitt. There wasn't one serve and volley point. And now the grass is not, the run-up where you serve 1-2-3 split step. The grass doesn't wear out there anymore because that's not what people are doing. Mm-hmm. Skyrocketed from the juniors to the pros. I think another key word in watching those tapes is just watch how deep he hits. Just the length of shot. Juniors don't rally enough, but they don't rally deep. You know, for a junior to take a private lesson and then go out, I would get myself in trouble, but I think a lot of juniors would be better off to just go hit a backboard than take lessons. Because, you know, you want the ball to go straight, come back straight. And they have a better chance of having better technique than the kid who's taking lessons. Because how can you let a kid play for 5 years where they're, as Robert Lansdorff would say, he said it one time, I just had the manuscript, it was at the tennis teachers conference in New York, you know, a few days before the main draw of the US Open started. And I wasn't there. I was at Tyler Junior College. I used to go every year, but that was, I couldn't go to the Open during that time because that's when registration was. That's where all these new students came in. And they had Burwash, they had the Bees, they had Burwash, Braden, Bolitari. There's a lot of other Bees. You go Ted Bartson or Glenn Bassett, but it was those three. They were headliners. And then it was Vandermeer and Lansdorff. And it was Lansdorff's turn to speak. You know, Vic went to, you know, talking about electric myography, his intellectual curiosity, whatever he was, this is what we need to do, brain typing and this and that. I used to tell Vic, I said, you go to those teachers' conferences, you should just teach people. Ask anybody they want any help with their strokes and have them just come out. And I was flattered at one point where he was doing that. You know, he said, oh, I'm going to use my name in third person. Steve Smith said, you know, and he's been to more of these than anybody. I should just have people come out and work on their strokes. And that's another whole podcast because Vic would always, he used to say, no, no. So it's such a positive guy, but use the word no. Not quite. And it wasn't showmanship. He'd get everybody laughing, but, you know, he'd get the person hitting the ball a little better and a little better and a little better. Then it was like, wow. And it was just really in a matter of minutes. But Lansdorff, you know, he basically said, for crying out loud, for fake sake, you know, he was holding back the curse words. But he goes, you know, he's talking to the USTA. He goes, you're bringing these kids in at 15. Can't you figure it out? That they're hanging on the racket like they're going to be carrying a frying pan. But watch those clips of Alex Mickelson playing on grass. Get your juniors to quit running around backhands. Wait for a short ball and go forward. You know, and don't hesitate to go forward. Play principle-based tennis. His toss, you know, his service motions, you know, very simple. I do think if you were comparing the best player in America right now is Taylor Fritz. You know, it's, I know the Davis Cup, TFO and Tommy Paul are not there. They didn't do so well the last time. So it's good that the U.S. has the depth. You know, try Sebastian Korda and Taylor Fritz and see how that goes. But I think that Alex Mickelson is a lesson for people to watch. I mean, he's obviously really good for the game. But I think that people will go, well, he lives in Southern California, and there's so many positives from that. And, you know, his father played college tennis, his mother played college tennis. That's all true. That's all true. That he has this leg up where we'll end, I guess we could end with that, ESTP. But the way he plays is he's not playing dumb. You know, you can't fix stupid. And then the thing about Myelin, good Myelin, people think it, they come to see us and they think Myelin's all about stroke reduction. Myelin's human behavior. Myelin's another word for habit. And people just have a habit of running around the ball. You know, a kid goes to their first instinct, you just see it when you do video analysis. Ball's coming, their first instinct is to turn for a forehand. And so now they have to turn. They're late for a backhand. So many kids, they actually look like they're tackling. They're being tackled when they hit a backhand. And actually the backhand, there is the side of it that the backhand, more players have a more efficient swing on the backhand side, but they don't hit it. So I mean, people could say, well, you said this about backhands. No, most kids, you know, hopefully they have a loop, the racket's up high. And because they have both hands on the racket, it's more in sync with the body. The best thing for really, really little kids is do some training where they hit a two-handed forehand. But yeah, we could talk about a couple other things with this, but California dream, and you know, it was not a dream for him to get where he is. It was obviously a nightmare work. But what about the ESTP? Why do you think that? You know the boy, the young man.
ESTP, he's definitely an extrovert. He loved to be around people. You know, in his free time, he wouldn't go alone by himself. Talking about on the court, I wasn't much involved. Well, you know, I'm 5 years older. Maybe my sister can answer that better. But off the court, I don't know. Well, on the court, lessons over, he'd want to talk with the coach, the players, the other, anybody really. So you're definitely an E. S, he's in the moment. I mean, he does not think about the future. He's not thinking about the outcome. He wants to be right in the competition, right in the point. He's thinking about, okay, this ball right here. So he's definitely sensei. He's a thinker. He's like we mentioned a couple times, he doesn't break down after matches. It's winning and losing isn't everything to him. He thinks through problems. So he's willing to try new things out. If he's losing, he'll just try new things. He'll drop shot more. He'll come to the net more. He'll serve and volley more. He'll target one area, one just the forehand, just the backhand. So he's willing to try and think through his problems. Where I see a lot of players, you know, it's a big brain line. If they worse from the back of the court, then you can just mail in the scores. They don't have a backup plan. And then P, he's a perceiver. I don't know him, if he's organized or not very organized. I'm not sure, but he definitely doesn't judge other people. He'll play with anybody like we talked about. And he's a great guy to be around. Just good memories from what I remember. One other comment about that I wrote down here from what I remember talking to him and just asking about his goals, and you know, with the coach, we'd be, hey, okay, what's everyone's goals? What do you like to do? You know, month goal, year goal, 4 year goal. And I remember, I believe, I might get the years wrong, but I think it was 2021 that he, it was summertime 2021 and we were in this hitting group and the coach asked us, okay, what are your goals for this year? And I remember Alex saying, well, I want to try and make the main draw of a junior major. He hadn't played one yet. And he's 19 now. That was 3 years ago. So, you know, around 16 years old, I'd say. And, you know, he had a high UTR. I remember it was around 11, I'd say. Just to guess, 11-2. So he was a great player, but hadn't played a junior major yet. And, you know, within a year, he jumped 2 UTR spots, started winning pro events. Within another year, he started winning challenger events and he cracked the top 200, 100. And now he's in the main draw of a men's major. And it's amazing how quickly his belief in himself just springboarded him to the top. It's a great story. It's great.
With on the ESTP, so many things. If someone's a P, they're a perceiver versus a flexor. ESTP, a perceiver versus a judger. You know, I remember one time a tennis parent saying to me about their kid is, you're not in a position of judgment. You know, so people end up coming to visit us and it's like, okay, how'd you get here? You know, someone told them to come here. And we have a whole different approach than someone who has to deal with the local yokels. I mean, I always tease, we have prisoners, you know, they got off an airplane, they're here, they got nowhere to go. They can't go 5 miles down the road and go to another place where someone can tell them what they want to hear. A P smiles. And I tease people, I'm a J, I smile like twice a year. A P, they laugh more. A P is going to go to a restaurant and they're going to try something different on the menu. I mean, I go to a restaurant. I mean, I've been here before. I'm just going to get the same thing. Just spice of life. But, you know, I love the backstory. And the P's are so fortunate if they have a J in their life. You know, then they have a J in their life who knows sports. You know, so obviously it sounds like Alex Mickelson was brought up by two athletes. So that's another leg up. I mean, yeah, he was born in sunny Southern California, born into tennis. Just like Eric Diaz, born into tennis. But that expression, blossom where you plant, tennis players come from everywhere. I mean, that's helping. You know, don't have a chip on your shoulder because you're from the snowbanks of, you know, where I grew up in upstate New York, or a Canadian kid or whatever. Tennis players come from everywhere. But the P's, the ISTP, the best brain type versus the ESTP, the I can focus better. You know, the E's on the front side of this ESTP, the E's can deal with more stress. It's not where you get your energy from. That's where, to read the article put together by Vic Braden and Joel Trucker that's on our website, or better yet, you know, start studying John Niednagel. You know, and then even study Myers-Briggs as a mother daughter from the 50s. We have an entire podcast on it with, you know, like Jimmy Connors is an I and Pete Sampras is an E. That throws people way off. But it's where you get your energy from. So here that he's a people person. If you could pick one of the preferences out, you'd want to be an S. Like Michael Jordan, I know, a fact checker, that at one time, maybe it still exists, where he'd missed more game-winning shots than anybody in the history of the NBA. You know, like I grew up where, you know, my father and one of my brothers, they idolized Mickey Mantle. And, you know, was, I guess, certain years, Roger Maris, a home run champion. But the people hit the home runs, they also strike out. And, you know, that's where, you know, the, like say a Chris Everett going way back, date myself, or a Stan Smith. Stan Smith, he became a net rusher, but the J's, the all court, he played all court tennis, but they learn out a routine. Where the P's, and it sounds like this is how mix this in, I guess I'll try that. I'll try that.
Yeah.
And, you know, mix it up, where most kids are so stressed about winning, they don't even play patterns. Remember Dave Secker, another guest on our podcast, he asked Sophia Patel, who we worked with for a long time. Matt Clore first started working with her. I met her when she was 11, but I spent a lot of time coaching her, and she has nice volleys and nice overheads. And we were at the National Clay Courts in Memphis, and Secker said, "Don't you think volleys and overheads are fun? You know, go up there and hit a volley, hit an overhead." You know, I have a son, Connor. The reason that he did well at the net, many, many reasons. I mean, oh yeah, we taught, you know, a pretty solid technique, but his older brother, a year and a half older, he didn't miss. It's like, well, if I could have a chance, you know, I've got to go to the net. It's like Braden used to say about Borg versus Vilas. He goes, "I just don't get it. If you've lost to him 20 times in a row, are you just mix it up?" You know, that's Vic's line. If one baseliner is playing another baseliner and the one baseliner is better, it's just mailing the score. But yeah, I think even where, like say Alex Mickelson, where he stands, how he turns for the forehand and backhand, how he keeps the racket up high, that gives him options on the return. And, you know, it's just fun to watch him play. On the tee, people have to realize that you're both. You're a thinker and a feeler. Thinkers can feel and feelers can think. And this is, you know, it's broken down 60-40. It's not scientifically validated. It doesn't put anybody in a box, but it's just a great tool. And, you know, like both Williams sisters are feelers. You know, for the longest time, the only person who could beat Serena was Serena. You know, she lost it, she lost it. She got unraveled. She was flappable at times. But she's hitting second serves bigger than the men. I mean, take a second look, what's going on? And, you know, talk about, you know, a little, not as much of a circular swing on the backhand side. I mean, look at Venus, how she hit a backhand. I think that's something too with, you know, you don't want to get teched out. You don't want to get teched out where you overthink, you know, so you can overthink paralysis by analysis. I don't think that, and I think that's a very good thing that Alex Mikkelsen he's not overthinking it. He's not teched out. Coming back to so many things, I was told today, this Canadian visitor told me that Denis Shapovalov won today. I would never understand why, you know, he's in Toronto. You know, Miron Mann was a sparring partner for him as a young kid. Is that why he wouldn't go back and go, okay, you know, help me with my volleys? But I think what happens that people think, well, that was then and this is now. You work on basics. You always work on basics. So if you look at other sports, but tennis players, they don't get it. Other sports, you're forced. You're standing at a foul line in basketball. Okay, you got to make the shot. You're standing still. It's equivalent to drop hitting a ball. And, you know, I can just go on and on, and that's been brought up. That's what we're trying to do in these podcasts, is just trying to reinforce common sense for ball striking, for fundamentals. But yeah, ESTP, they take charge. You know, the ENTJ, that's the CEO. It's amazing. ESTPs are quarterbacks. ENTJs are CEO leaders or politicians. This is a famous thing, topic with John Niednagel, is that I believe it was the San Diego Chargers, but they took Ryan Leaf and then Peyton Manning, and Ryan Leaf, a great college quarterback, he was an ESTJ, and Peyton Manning was an ESTP. But people need to know this, that you, in tennis, you need to know there's options. You need to be able to adjust. You need to make adjustments. I tell the juniors all the time, I said, okay, let's just watch these players hit. You know, it could be Steve Campbell's staff was running a clinic with some ladies from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I said, don't let the ladies know that you're watching them, but you know, just watch. So the brain typing, but also watching how they hit the tennis ball. You know, you really, if you, you know, study technique, study tennis, become a student of the game, you can watch somebody hit one ball. You can watch somebody just hit one ball. I could tell this story about playing a major. I was married for, as Lou Holtz would say, I was married 40 years, 20 for her and 20 for me. A strange and wonderful relationship, and people would know that she was wonderful and I was strange. With my son Connor, my son Mikhail was a scheduled, no, he was a C-section. My son Connor was a scheduled C-section. So that meant he could be born between December 19th and January 7th. And, you know, life's not fair. You know, man doesn't become pregnant. And I don't talk about Bill Cosby too much anymore, but Bill Cosby had a joke of, if a man wants to experience giving birth, they just take their top lip and they pull it up over their head. that might throw people a little off, but there's some humor in that for some. And I begged to have my son born on December 19th. Or excuse me, no. I begged to have him be born in January. If you're born in December, it helps you with your taxes a little bit, but born in January, so then you had a better chance to play the majors, or even like, say, in ice hockey, the sport I grew up in, is if you're a January birthday. Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, which I think everyone should read, story of success, story of circumstance. Second, I think it's the second chapter, that the Canadian kid was born in the first quarter of the year. At age five, they get all these perks because they're selected to be talented. They end up getting more ice time, and they're put in more of an accelerated process. The story of circumstance. But it's a great story. You go, yeah, I hope to be playing majors in the blink of an eye instead of playing juniors. When Roger Federer played junior Wimbledon, he won it. His junior Wimbledon won it. He went to the Wimbledon ball. And this is perspective for you. And Federer was ushered off to futures, where he got a wild card and he's in the main draw. He actually lost to Rodrigo Navarro, who's 10 years older. Carla Navarro, she's been a guest. I mean, I've known her forever. Great, great person, great family. But Federer didn't want to leave Wimbledon. because he thought I may never be back here. Just because a kid does really well in the juniors, you know, you're playing the junior majors, it doesn't mean that you're going to play the majors. Yeah, we're going to talk about some odds and ends in the next podcast. I mean, I spent quite a bit of time watching the juniors play. What a celebration of tennis, a fortnight. It's a little bit more than a fortnight. And we're so fortunate in tennis to have four Super Bowls. That's what we really have. But I wanted to ask you, Eric Diaz and his partner, Jay Leavitt. I apologize to the man. But Welby Van Horn was asked, you know, what are some of the reasons you had so much success? And he said he was lucky to coach Charlie Passerell early in his career. I talk about somebody hit the ball really well. And Charlie Passerell, I think people know him now most for starting Indian Wells. Then he sold it along with his partner, Ray Moore. But great, great player. I mean, people could go to the internet and just plug in Pancho Gonzalez, Charlie Passerell, and watch the late Gonzalez play Charlie Passerell. It's a famous match. But Welby said he was lucky to teach someone early in his career who went on and became such a really good player. But tell me about the other player, Lerner Tion,
yeah.
So what about him? I mean, it's got to help to have two golden apples. I mean,
yeah, for sure. He, Nelly Gale Ranch Tennis Club. I remember Lerner being this. I can call him chubby now because he's not chubby anymore. But he was this kid, like four years old, chubby kid, small, and just starting to play tennis. And he was on the court next to me. And oh, what's this kid's name? Lerner. What an interesting name, Lerner. And
it is a great name.
Great name. And I just remember him hitting balls, and he could hit with like 12-year-olds. And we're like, whoa, like this kid's going to be something. And then he ended up getting to a level where Alex and himself were playing for, you know, national titles. And I feel like they pushed each other to get better. And they were battling for spots like one and two or three in the in their section, or their 18s, I think, nationally. And so when Lerner, I think, also committed, actually, I might be wrong, I think Lerner is going to college, but there are quite a few of those juniors that hit the 18s just before turning and committing to college that did end up going pro. For example, another kid, not locally, we were talking about Lerner Tien and Alex Mickelson from that Southern California area, Ali Suviejo. Another kid, Ethan Quinn, who, circling back, was also at that challenger, got to talk to, congratulate him. I don't know him, but he played a year of college and decided to go pro. So I feel like that group of players obviously know each other very well, and they push each other, and so it creates a good culture for just getting better. But Lerner, yeah, he won Kalamazoo twice.
For our listeners, Kalamazoo is a couple of thoughts on that. Kalamazoo, Michigan. My brother-in-law is from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I like that place. They do a great job with the tournament. A couple things. One, it's the boys 16s and 18s national championship. And it's done really well. It's a big deal. I mean, for a junior to win Kalamazoo, it used to be they didn't let so many players in. I mean, the draws have been as large as 192. I know a coach years ago ran a camp. I wish I was at Kalamazoo. I knew another coach he ran a camp. I wish I was at sectionals. And that was a t-shirt he gave out because, you know, the kids weren't, there were so many people playing tennis. It was so difficult to get the sectionals. They used to call it the Westerns. The Midwest was the Westerns. And, you know, those were back before kids went to academies. And it's a fact that better players came out of the Midwest before the advent of the academies. And, you know, for someone to go and win the Westerns, to win your section, but just to be able to go. So they have a t-shirt, I wish I was at sectionals. You know, I wish I was at the zoo. So those guys are a year apart, same year. They practice, they play together.
Same year.
They had to see each other quite a bit in the local tournaments.
Oh, all the time. Yeah. There, you can go online, just type in Alex Mikkelsen versus Lerner Tien and their, national finals that they play in.
But even Southern Cal stuff.
Even Southern Cal stuff. Yeah.
This is very powerful. If a name is escaping me right now, but I tell this, quite often, rainy days, trying to motivate, better word, trying to discipline junior tennis players. If he can do it, I can do it. There's so many stories. You know, Tim Gullickson, he met Hank Jungle, the late Tim Gullickson, and I was fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with Tim. And this was at the Kettering Racquet Club in Dayton, Ohio, fact checker. And Hank Jungle was a very good player, but you know, he starts playing this young guy who came out of Northern Illinois and said, this guy's the real deal. And he tells Tim, I'll help you to play pro tennis. So how old are you? You come out of college, you know, 22, 23, he's teaching. So he gives it a crack and he starts climbing the ladder. I mean, I think he got as high as 15 in the world, 17, if I had to bet, but maybe 15, but year end, 17, great tennis player with great wins. But his twin brother, Tom, who everybody loves, says, hey, if he could do it, I could do it. And he actually wasn't ranked as high, but he was ranked in the top 50 longer. And, you know, these guys are from a small town, Wisconsin. They're in the Wimbledon finals playing doubles. So if he can do it, I can do it. Bud Schultz went to Bates, another guest on our podcast, and got to be 39 in the world. And I'm just, as soon as we sign off, I'll think of the name. But the story goes is that, you know, I mean, he was climbing the pro ranks, and then a guy that he had played in juniors said, hey, if he can do it, I can do it. And at that time, the player was just playing New England Open tournaments, amateur tournaments. And he climbed where he was the top 100 in the world. You know, so you got to believe you can do it with, you know, it's like Roger Bannister when he broke the 4 minute mile. I'm not sure in 1950, it was 54, but I mean, four, five, six people broke it within the same year. And if he can do it, I can do it. One of the best stories for that is Michael Steek. You know, he's basically like, say, Lerner and Alex, same age. Becker wins Wimbledon at 17. And that's an amazing story. You know, people are talking so much about Alcaraz. He's awesome. But so is Becker at 17. And, you know, people short memories and they're just talking about the here and now. And you know, just think about it, what, you know, Becker did on the return of serve. And people say that you could never win on grass with a grip that was past three in Eastern. And he turned on three, had like Alex Mikkelsen, staying close and use a tabletop return, linear volley. You know, people who throw out the $14 words, well, the game used to be linear and now it's angular. It's like crock. Your movement initially is angular to coil your body, but the racket has to track out towards the target, you know, if you have any success. But so anyway, Boris Becker, he wins Wimbledon. Michael Steek goes off to university, comes back end of the semester, tells his parents, if he can do it, I can do it. If Becker can win Wimbledon, I can make a living playing pro tennis. And 5 years later, he beat Becker in Wimbledon final. I was coaching in Germany, Christoph Mueller, I think it was 11 states. I was watching, you know, the 16s, it was one court over, state championship. And I saw Michael Steek playing, going, who is that guy? That guy is good. But a lot of times I tell kids that, you know, most tennis kids that work with coaches that we train, they come in, they're a much better tennis player than they think they are, but they don't allow themselves to be a better player. You know, I do say, oh, you're not living your life to win. But, you know, the Jimmy Connors line, are people playing Are people playing the way they're taught? But I would think that, I thought that learners signed to go to Stanford, but this is, I could be wrong.
I don't know where he signed to, but
a kid like that go anywhere he wants, right?
Oh yeah.
You know, if he has the academics, and I'm sure he does, you know, typically that people that are achieving in tennis, they're not getting D's and F's on the report card. But I would think that would be in his mind, like, if he could do it, I could do it.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
With how about his game? Does he have a big serve? I've never watched him play.
I watched him play a few times. I watched him in the first he played. He won Kalamazoo, so he's an American. He got to play the first round of the US Open twice. He took a set off Miomir Kecmanovic, who had a decent run in the Aussie Open this year, and then lost the next three. And then the US Open last year, I believe, I think he lost in three. I don't remember who. But his game, big forehand, circular, good serve. Backhand, I think I'm not going to comment too much more. I don't remember. But I do believe he doesn't force as well as Alex does. A short ball, I don't believe he has that. He wants to come in as much, I don't believe.
With, I think a number of podcasts, and I you know, like to go for walks and make a lot of phone calls. I like to call people back within 24 hours, but to listen to podcasts, I think so many podcasts are about or with famous people or people associated with famous people. And I think people that are playing tennis and they're doing podcasts, the people interviewing them shouldn't really ask about, hey, you know, what are you doing on your serve? What are you doing on your forehand? Mm-hmm. I'll end with this, and we're going to come back to more odds and ends with the Aussie Open. I know we didn't do any play-by-play or commentating. We could do that another time. The Aussie Open to me is jet lag. It's like, okay, we're not going to sleep so well for the next 2 weeks. But with, train of thought, help me out, senior moment.
Let's see, tracking backwards. Aussie Open, we didn't commentate on it. We're going to go with Andres Barbosa on the next podcast to talk about the odds and ends.
I was going to mention odds and ends. So I guess old age is a tough thing, but senior moment, I was going to say one other thing about, it's just putting things in perspective. Alex Mickelson is like, okay, I remember just in the summer, didn't have much time, but I, you know, read about what he was doing and you mentioned it. And it's like, this guy, where's this guy coming from? And he just beat this guy and that guy. And I had watched him play on those grass court matches at Newport. And it's like, wow, this is refreshing. This is different. This guy is not playing. You know, I say I get myself in trouble. Clones taught by clowns. What are you doing? And what are you doing? And, you know, I think also too, I do have notes, so I'll come back to the odds. And I was going to mention something that I know I'm going to talk with Andres Barbosa in the next podcast about the Aussie Open. But celebration of tennis, study tennis for 2 weeks. It's amazing to just be able to watch so much tennis. I mean, it was very, very good that you could see doubles, mixed doubles. With Mickelson, I don't think it's a matter of, asking him to be a guest on a podcast. What are you working on your forehand or your backhand? I think that, you know, that should be pretty private, really. This is what I'm trying to do, not sharing that with the public. But at the same time, there are no secrets out there. Braden used to say that a football player on a rainy day, you know, they lose and they put a big cape over their helmet and no one can see their emotions. But a tennis player is out there, Vic, you say they're wearing a little more than their underwear. And, you know, there's nowhere to hide. It's just you. And But yeah, you know, odds and ends, being for myself, being an outsider, for yourself to be an observer, a lot of things about Alex Mickelson, but watch those tapes and watch how he plays. Stay in the pocket. Don't run around your backhand from the wrong place. Stay in early, be able to steal the ace on the return, have patterns where you go forward. I think on the mental side, again, being repetitive, John Isner, unflappable, you know, that, you know, it's not loving to win, hating to lose. Can you compete? I tell juniors all the time, you only like tennis when you win. You know, no one wants to lose. You know, the Jimmy Connors saying, greatest thing in life is to play tennis, win. Second greatest thing in life is to play tennis and lose. That young man is got a good hand from section F, sitting up high from 30,000 feet above. He's got a really good handle on things, and I think he's a walking tennis lesson. Anything else?
No, I agree with what you said. Yeah, he's great to watch, great to learn from. Looking forward to see how he does this season. Obviously, he's in, I believe he's like 73 in the world now with his Aussie Open third round appearance. So he's going to get into the main draws of the other three majors. So we'll see how he does in those.
I tell juniors, you know, you never want to go with a wish, a hope, and prayer. If you're going to pray, more power to you. But pray for world peace. But with your own game, don't be wishful or hopeful for a second. And with that, I just, you know, my wish for him, my hope for him was he just stays healthy. He stays healthy. He's, you know, he's not going anywhere. I mean, he has the game. It's not a fluke. But the thing is that there's only the four parts of tennis, and it all comes back to one: is mentally, emotional is first, technical, tactical, and then physical. Like Coach K used to say, well, you got five players, you put your hand like this, it's weak, you make a fist, it's strong. But you have to take those four components and be really good at all of them. And, but yeah, anyway, California dreaming. Mm-hmm. All right. Give me the high five. Yvonne, and also thanks, Yvonne. He's the man behind the scenes, and he does so much to help the Great Base. So thank you, Yvonne, and, thank you, Alex, and everybody associated with him. Mm-hmm. It's great to have a player like that to watch. And then thank you for listening to our Great Base Tennis podcast.
Thank you all.
Adios, amigos.